From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Oakland County's tally of confirmed measles cases climbs as attention focuses on anyone who is not vaccinated.
Two doses have been recommended. People who are adults now may have only received one vaccine, which is why it's important to contact their health care provider and check.
A new state task force looks at guardianship of elders in Michigan.
Usually it's a plenary guardian, which means that the guardian has the obligation to make almost all decisions in the person's life.
Most people don't realize that professional guardians work for free for about half of their caseloads.
Plus, a new exhibition highlights the humanitarian crisis at our southern border.
If death isn't going to stop people from continuing to come, why would we think that some kind of wall would?
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello, welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The number of confirmed measles cases in Oakland County has now grown to 18. That's just one shy of the entire number of cases scattered across this state for all of last year. Here with us now is Leanne Stafford, the health officer with the Oakland County Health Department, and also Dr. Pamela Hackert, a physician with the Oakland County Health Department. Leanne, 18 confirmed cases. Are there any possible cases being reviewed by the lab?
On a daily basis, when we get cases, we're sending them to the state, and so we are actually pending three cases at this time.
Has anyone been hospitalized that you know of?
We have not been informed of anyone being hospitalized at this time. That actually is a confirmed case of measles. You know, people are hospitalized for other things and may be tested, but at this case, there's not been that reported to us.
And this outbreak in Oakland County appears to have begun with a traveler from Israel who visited Oakland County from March 6th to the 13th. Do you have reason to believe that all of these confirmed cases are linked to that patient zero?
At this time, as we continue to do the investigation, it does seem to appear that they do have an epi link to our initial case.
And what does that phrase epilink mean?
That just means that there was some exposure to or they were present at a location where that initial case indicated that they were when they were contagious.
Are these cases contained within a specific community?
You know, at this time, it's not a community within Oakland County. They're just in the community of Oakland County. There's not one specific location. As you can see, there are cases in Southfield. We have cases in Oak Park. So it's basically just in Oakland County and not just, you know, in one location.
And we could remind everyone, you can go to the Oakland County Health Department website at oakgov.com/health, and you can see the full list of exposure locations. Dr. Hackert, how dangerous is measles?
Measles is actually quite concerning. It has a risk of some side effects. Most of the side effects are more mild, such as ear infections, diarrhea, which can be particularly severe in infants because they can easily get dehydrated. But it does carry about a 1 in 1,000 case of brain involvement, which can be concerning, and also about a 1 in 1,000 cases, there is a risk of death.
It's a good time now, I think, as we talk about this, to remind people of what symptoms they should be aware of.
So usually the first symptom that would appear, and this usually appears 10 to 12 days after exposure, is a sudden onset of fever. And that fever is usually at least about 101, can spike up to 104, though. And then the classic called prodrome, which is a way of saying before you get the full-blown measles case, the symptoms to watch for are conjunctivitis, which is redness of the eyes, kind of itching, coryza, which is another way of saying runny nose, and then a cough.
And then we certainly have seen photos since the national outbreak of measles began of the rash. Tell us about that rash.
So the rash would normally begin at the top of the head, and it spreads down almost like you're pulling a shade down, and it can begin within 1 to 3 days after the fever onset, and then it starts out as small dots, and then it can spread, and one of the things about it is it is actually a raised rash.
is we talk now with Dr. Pamela Hackard of the Oakland County Health Department and Leanne Stafford, the health officer of the Oakland County Health Department, talking about the 18 confirmed measles cases in Oakland County. And you contrast that with the fact there were 19 confirmed cases, Leanne, all through the state in 2018. In 1994, the state had 26 cases in the entire year through the state. We're not even at the end of March, and Oakland County has confirmed 18 cases, and you say three are pending. How big a deal is this outbreak?
Again, measles in the community and it being very contagious and highly contagious, you know, is serious. And so what we're doing is continuing to keep communication with the community, sending out press releases with additional locations where exposure may have occurred, and talking about the importance of vaccination. This is a vaccine preventable disease, and so we're really reaching out and trying to talk to the community about the importance of vaccination. And actually not just one vaccination, but showing or having two documented vaccines for measles so that we can continue to protect our families and our community around us.
Dr. Hackard, let me ask you that question, too. How big a deal, as you know, as a physician who works in public health, how big a deal is this outbreak where you have 18 cases just in Oakland County and we're not even at the end of March?
Whenever you have something that's spread by the respiratory pathway, that's a concern because you can have someone walk by you. You don't have to have any interaction and you can actually catch the infection from them. And then with this, you know, silent incubation period of several days, you may not know you're incubating it, and then you have the fever onset and can still be spreading it. Usually the rash shows up, and at the time of the rash, most people would be able to identify that this is measles, but there are those days before when it may just be mistaken as a common cold. So it is concerning, but one of the things I would add to Ms. Stafford's message is that if you get the measles vaccine within 3 days of being exposed, that can actually prevent you from developing measles.
And to that point, you're both bringing up the issue of vaccination and the importance of that. Oakland County has one of the highest vaccination waiver rates in the state of Michigan. Is it time for Oakland County to have serious conversations at this point about excluding non-vaccinated children from school?
Well, up until this point right now, the majority of cases that we have seen have been over the age of 18. And so if we started to see additional kids, we would work with the schools where that exposure may have occurred. And those that are under vaccinated or not vaccinated may be excluded at that time once there would be an exposure at the school.
How will you know when this outbreak has peaked?
There won't be something that will necessarily tell us at the time that it has peaked. It's going to be more of a retrospective analysis of cases. And a similar type of outbreak occurred in Minnesota a few years back, and they kind of had to wait because you have to wait a full 21 days from the last measles case in the community to say that it's over.
So understanding this silent incubation period, do you have any sense of when this peak could happen? I know you say you look at retroactively, but kind of assembling all the pieces you have, what do you think?
Well, as we are still finding new cases, those cases then would serve as the baseline count going forward. So we can't really say when that last case is going to happen until we, you know, at least pass the 21 days. And with each new case, those are additional potential exposures where they have been in the community.
I know that you've been very clear encouraging all Oakland County residents who haven't been vaccinated to do so. Leanne, how many have done that so far to your knowledge?
Well, since our first outreach clinic, which was on the 15th of March, we've done over 1,200 vaccinations. But I think a big piece to really emphasize is since Friday the 22nd, 23rd, and 24th, we were out in the community and also at our individual health division locations, and we did over 970 doses.
And I know it's worth reminding folks right now, you have more opportunities to get vaccinated Wednesday from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. at Young Israel of Oak Park on 10 Mile Road. Then, of course, always there's the Oakland County Health Division offices in Southfield and Pontiac. Dr. Hackert, what do you hope that Oakland County residents do with all this information? And even beyond that, people who are in beyond Oakland County and who are listening to this conversation?
Well, I think the most important thing is to contact their healthcare provider and to ensure that they actually do have two vaccines on board. Measles vaccine is a standard childhood vaccine. And in the last, I can't tell you the exact date, but in the last certain amount of time, two doses have been recommended. People who are adults now may have only received one vaccine, which is why it's important to contact their healthcare provider and check, because if they've only received one in an outbreak setting such as this at this time, we are recommending that they go in and get a second vaccine.
So if someone has some symptoms and they're not sure if they've been vaccinated, what are the do's and don'ts, Leanne?
Well, the one thing we want to tell people that if you are showing signs and symptoms and you maybe have been exposed at one of the locations, is we're asking that you do not show up at your doctor's office or emergency room unless you call ahead so that they can take the proper precautions to prevent the exposure to other individuals that maybe are in the waiting room or maybe at the doctor's offices. And that's very important that you call ahead.
What kind of coordination, Leanne, is happening with your counterparts, or Dr. Hackert, you may address this as well, elsewhere in Michigan? We're talking to people all over the state. And this really is, when you talk about a public health issue like this, it goes beyond the immediate county. What kind of coordination is going on?
On a daily basis, we're working with our regional partners, with our state partners, you know, especially now with the measles outbreak. We actually work daily with the state departments, and we're also staying in contact with the other health divisions that may border us or be close to us, just to keep them updated on what's going on in Oakland County so they can be aware and take precautions when necessary in their jurisdictions.
Dr. Pamela Hackert, physician with the Oakland County Health Department, and Leanne Stafford, the health officer with the Oakland County Health Department. We want to thank you for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you, Cindy, for your interest in public health.
Coming up, a new exhibition highlights the humanitarian crisis at our southern border.
If death isn't going to stop people from continuing to come, why would we think that some kind of wall would?
The new project, Hostile Terrain 94, coming up. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. Listening to Stateside, I'm Cynthia Canty. It is time to check in on a very, very busy time for theater all around Michigan as we say hello to David Kiley of Encore Michigan. And David, I understand you and the team at Encore Michigan are hopping all over covering show openings this month?
Yes, we've got more than 20 show openings this month. It's one of sort of the three busiest months of the year. It's almost like the theaters come out of hibernation.
Spring has sprung. I understand you did see Hamilton at the Fisher Theater in Detroit.
I did. I was lucky to see it on media night. I had seen it in Chicago, so I did have something to compare this production to. And I have to say, I loved it. You know, the story in the script by Lin-Manuel Miranda is so strong. And they're doing such a good job of casting the touring shows. And if you don't have tickets yet, the producers are still releasing some tickets to people who have entered the lottery system. And Miranda gave the crowd a bit of a thrill when he appeared on stage last Tuesday, having signed some posters that some patrons paid, I think, $1,000 each for as part of a fundraiser.
Yeah, in fact, you can go to his Twitter feed, which is always a treat, and you see him off stage going, shh, I'm here. But indeed, and anyone who wants to know about the lottery system, you go through the Hamilton app. And they have been also, the box office has been releasing some tickets, I've been hearing from people. So it's worth checking the Broadway in Detroit Facebook page even, because they'll make that announcement.
Yeah, this is all part of the effort to, you know, have a counterweight to all of the, you know, what is essentially ticket scalping of Hamilton tickets. They're trying to democratize it as much as possible.
Now let's talk about the Monster Box Theater in Waterford.
Yeah, so they are doing David Mamet's classic Glengarry Glen Ross. This is one of those plays that's taken on a new life since the amazing movie was made from this play in the early 90s, and the phrase "always be closing" has entered pop culture. And this cast up at Monster Box is very good. If you like Mamet and this play, seriously, go up. Give this theater a look if you have not been there before. The actor who plays Shelley Levine, which is an incredibly important part in this play, Jack Lemmon played it in the movie, is very good, and his character is really the key.
All right, so that's worth checking in Waterford at the Monster Box Theater. Now to the Matrix Theater in Detroit with something that really seems ripped right from the headlines.
Yeah, it's a play called Interference. And this is a timely play about sexual assault. It focuses on a victim of date rape that was perpetrated by a college quarterback. The structure of this play is very interesting, and it's very compelling. I saw it this past weekend. Around the lead actress who plays the victim, there's an ensemble of actors who play all the characters who enter into this case. The prosecutor, the defense attorney, the coach, the investigating detective, the quarterback's father, her father, a reporter. The arc of the story is what happens from the time the rape took place to the ending of the story, and I won't give the ending away. One of the things that caught my attention is that before the play starts, a screen just keeps scrolling through a Google search, the screen on stage, a Google search of college campus sexual assault stories. It's endless, Cynthia. It's really an eye-opener. I know we know it takes place, but this play really brings the preponderance of this problem to your eyes. Tackles a very heavy subject with a special kind of energy and immersion. And I got to tell you, it really should make us understand how much this issue is an actual societal emergency that we're not taking seriously enough. The statistics on campus sexual assault are shattering.
All right. That sounds very, very, very compelling and educational at the same time. And now we're going to shift gears completely.
Yes.
And look ahead to some openings this weekend. Let's see if this rings any bells.
If you're blue and you don't know where to go to, why don't you go where fashion sits?
And that takes us back to 1974, Mel Brooks' classic film, Young Frankenstein. So who's doing this production, David?
That's the University of Detroit Mercy Theater Company. And of course, as you say, it's based on the Mel Brooks film. It's and the movie, as well as the show, is really a parody of a movie I happen to love called The Son of Frankenstein, which is an old horror movie with Basil Rathbone playing the son of the mad scientist. And I expect it to be a lot of fun. It's hard not to do a good job on the show.
Yeah, kudos to them for kind of making everybody smile at the University of Detroit Mercy. And then we wind up at the Tipping Point in Northville.
Yeah, so Tipping Point's doing a play, a relatively new play called Popcorn Falls. This I've seen another production of this show, and I got to say, the writing is really top drawer. It takes place in a small town, and the only tourist attraction is a waterfall, and it's dried up. And the town is bankrupt, but they can snare a special grant if they can mount a play, which they have exactly 1 week to pull off. But the problem is they don't have a play, they don't have a place to perform it. But that does not deter the mayor of this town and a local handyman. It's a two-person play, two actors, but they play 15 characters. It's very funny, very well done, heartily recommended, and that's at the Tipping Point in Northville.
Nothing more fun than seeing actors who are so versatile that they can jump from one character to another to another. That is a blast to see.
That is where the talent comes in. There's a number of plays like that floating around, and when they're done well, it's really funny.
Just to recap then, Popcorn Falls at Tipping Point in Northville. University of Detroit Mercy, UDM, is opening its production of Young Frankenstein. The Matrix Theater in Detroit offering a new play on date rape called Interference. Monster Box Theater in Waterford bringing us David Mamet's Glengarry Glen Ross. And Hamilton continues at the Fisher through April. So you could still score some seats, as we talked about. There are ways for that to happen. You can learn about these productions and many more by going to EncoreMichigan.com. David Codley, as always, thank you.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Turning to our immigration crisis, it seems every day we hear something about it. It continues to build, with President Trump doubling down on his demand for billions to build a wall at our southern border. A new project called Hostile Terrain 94 tries to redirect our attention to the people crossing the U.S.-Mexico border. University of Michigan anthropologist Jason DeLeon is founder of the Undocumented Migration Project and creator of Hostile Terrain 94, also the author of The Land of Open Graves, Living and Dying on the Migrant Trail. Jason DeLeon, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you for having me back.
It has been a few years. That was some 6 years ago. We sat down and talked with you here. We had a great conversation about your growing collection of the artifacts left behind by migrants coming to the U.S. from Mexico. I remember you talking about the children's backpacks and the children's clothing. So you're an anthropologist, you're an archaeologist, and I'm wondering how you've taken that skill set in the years since to tell the stories of these migrants.
Well, it's funny. A lot has happened since I was last here, and I feel like my career seems to be taking a lot of left turns periodically. And so there's been a series of left turns that have ended me up here and, you know, thinking about exhibition work and artwork in relationship to the anthropological work, the archaeological work. And, you know, I think now when I was here last time, we were still in the midst of really collecting a lot of these materials. We stopped collecting probably around 2014, partly because we ran out of room. But then we also started to think about, okay, what can we do with these objects that migrants have left behind that we have collected? How can we write about them, analyze them? But then also, how can we translate them for different kinds of spaces? And so the art exhibition stuff started happening around 2013 and has only really been growing since then. But we've been using those artifacts both to write about them academically as well as to use them in exhibition work.
And the Undocumented Migration Project covers what? All of this activity and then some?
You know, it began with very humble kinds of goals, and it was to see, okay, what can we learn about border crossings in southern Arizona? And now, you know, we've spent a decade in southern Arizona, but we've also been working along the Guatemala-Mexico border since 2015, been covering all of Mexico since then. And so bouncing around from Honduras to southern Mexico to northern Mexico to Arizona to New York, we've been moving around, but trying to understand different aspects of this process.
And since you were on this program in the summer of 2013, we now have a president who's intensely focused on keeping these migrants out of this country. How has President Donald Trump affected the work you do?
In many ways, it's really inspired me to work harder. I have two small kids at home, and I think that at the end of 2016, I got to a point where I was thinking, okay, I can either be totally demoralized about the sort of state of affairs and the ways in which a certain segment of the American population is thinking about immigration and our immigration history, or I can try to find some sort of positive thing to look forward to and to work towards. And so I think in some ways, you know, Trump has really inspired me to work harder, to do more public outreach, make my work more accessible to an audience that maybe wouldn't want to read an academic book or, you know, read a journal article.
So, which leads us to this new project, Hostile Terrain 94. What is it?
So Hostile Terrain 94 is a collaboration between myself, our longtime photographer, Michael Wells, and Detroit-based curator and graphic artist, Lucy Cahill. And it is a public installation piece, basically It's a giant wall map of Arizona with 3,034 handwritten toe tags for the bodies that have been recovered in southern Arizona since about 2000. And so these tags contain name, location, age, sex, cause of death, GPS coordinates, county. There's about 1,200 of them that are unidentified bodies, bodies that have been recovered but still have not been repatriated. There's orange tags for the unidentified and manila for those who have been identified. This project started, you know, this iteration of it started as a piece that's up at the Phillips Art Museum in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, that we put up 2 months ago. And during the course of making this giant toe tag wall that was really constructed by about six undergraduate students at the University of Michigan who spent 2 months filling out these toe tags, it's mounted on a wall in the exact location where these bodies had been found. So it's a very big piece. It's about 16 feet long and about 10 feet tall. In the midst of working on this exhibition piece for Lancaster, for the Phillips Museum, I got the idea that what would happen then if we did this in other locations, but instead of us building it, we would then say, here's a community that's interested in this issue. We're going to give you the kit. We'll give you all the toe tags. We'll give you all the information. And then it's your job to organize your community to come together and to fill out these tags and to make this piece. And it really came out of the fact that I was thinking, well, it was impactful for us to spend the time to handwrite out the names of the dead.
Thinking of the names.
I mean, really, I mean, yeah. Very challenging for the students, for myself. When we finished the piece in Lancaster, we all kind of took a step back, and it was a very heavy thing. You know, you spend time engaging with these names, and especially the unidentified. And so I thought, well, rather than putting this up someplace else where people can just come and kind of maybe gawk at it, what happens if we ask people to then commit themselves to helping to make this? And so in some sort of show of solidarity and of commitment, even if it's only for half an hour, to fill out five toe tags and to put them on this wall. So then I got the idea, okay, what if we do that someplace else? And then I was thinking, well, okay, we're coming up on an election cycle. People are going to be talking more and more about immigration as we move forward. No one's talking about migrant deaths in the desert or in Texas, really. What if we do this in 94 locations as a symbolic nod to the year that this policy that created all these deaths happened?
The prevention through deterrence policy, yes.
So what if we did that in 94 locations and we asked thousands of people to come together from around the globe to do this and to do it all at the same time? And so Hostile Terrain will debut in the fall of 2020 all across the U.S., all across Latin America. We're working on, we have representation right now in Italy and England. We're trying to get into other places globally. Everyone will do it over a three-week period, and on Friday, October 3rd, 2020, it'll be up in 93 locations at once. People will be live streaming this, will be tweeting it. They'll be modifying it in their own kind of locally specific ways. And then what we're going to do is ask everybody to send back all of the toe tags. So over 300,000 will be sent back to us, and then we will go to Washington, D.C. and make our 94th exhibition, I hope, within walking distance of the White House.
And you're going to actually be kind of doing a trial run, if we shall say that, and exhibiting Hostile Terrain 94 from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. March 27th, 28th, and 29th at Mason Hall on the University of Michigan campus. How do you answer, Jason, the people who believe deeply that these migrants who are walking to the United States from Mexico through the desert are breaking our laws, and that a country can't just have wide open borders letting in whomever turns up?
Oftentimes the argument about this whole legal, illegal thing, it's a really easy way to simplify this whole thing. And the people who typically are arguing, well, illegal is illegal and these are kind of lawbreakers, they're the folks who don't understand, number one, the history of U.S. immigration, how it hasn't always been this way in terms of how we accept immigrants and refugees. Many of their ancestors came here probably illegally or came here during times where it was easy to bribe people. But more importantly, the folks who want to shut off the border don't want to recognize that these people are oftentimes fleeing issues that the U.S. is responsible for in some way, shape, or form. So the nightmare that is in Honduras and in the Golden Triangle, the political instability, the gang wars, the drug smuggling, the U.S. is deeply implicated in these things. So these are people fleeing oftentimes U.S.-constructed problems, coming to the United States to ask for help, and then we want to say, well, it's not our problem, when in fact it is our problem. We're very much implicated in a lot of this stuff. And I think whether we're talking about Latin America or talking about Syria or talking about Africa, I think that these governments where we're faced with this humanitarian crisis right now, their populations have to realize that these are global issues that aren't going away anytime soon, and that we need to start thinking about comprehensive immigration reform to deal with this crisis that is only going to get worse.
And you are hoping that this installation plants some new thoughts in people's mind, a new way of looking at this problem?
Yeah, I mean, for some people, it'll be their first time engaging with any of this stuff. And so I think in some ways, it's this public service of, I just want to educate you about this issue. If you're a pro-wall, I want you to understand that thousands have been dying for a long time. And these people know very well that there's a high likelihood of death crossing the Arizona desert, and yet they continue to do it. And so maybe by seeing their names up close, you can start to think about, well, God, how bad must it be if someone has risked this much? What must life be like on the other side? And then if death isn't going to stop people from continuing to come, why would we think that some kind of wall would? So in some ways, it's really to put this out into a public that they can at least get some more information, and also to kind of remember the historical depth of these things. Because right now, I mean, we're very much focused on this current crisis as if it's just kind of happened overnight. And I want people to think about this goes back decades.
Hostile Terrain 94 will be exhibited March 27th, 28th, and 29th at Mason Hall on the University of Michigan campus. And actually, you can learn more about this project, also the Undocumented Migration Project, by going to the website, which is easy to find, undocumentedmigrationproject.com. Jason De Leon, University of Michigan anthropology professor and the creator of Hostile Terrain 94. It's great talking with you. Thank you so very much.
Thank you for having me back.
Heads up, everybody, from the DNR. Humans aren't the only ones ready for spring and warmer weather. Black bears are coming out of hibernation, and they're hungry. Black bears are making their way farther south into Michigan's Lower Peninsula with sightings in places like South Haven and Cadillac. And the state wants us to make it tougher for bears to dive into nice, easily accessible food sources like your bird feeders and garbage cans. Bears find bird seed and suet delish and a lot easier than digging around for roots of early spring plants or insects in trees and logs. So advice from the DNR, keep your pet food inside a secured area, keep garbage secured, and protect any beehives, fruit trees, and gardens with electric fencing, or say hello to Mr. Bear. Coming up, a new state task force will look at guardianship of elders and others in Michigan.
In our guardianship system across the state last year, more than 10,000 petitions for guardianship were granted, but according to the Supreme Court statistics, fewer than 150 were denied.
That is after the break. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Protecting some of Michigan's most vulnerable, our seniors. That's the mission of a task force Attorney General Dana Nessel has rolled out, noting some 73,000 elderly people in Michigan are suffering some kind of elder abuse. This task force includes lawmakers, state Supreme Court justices, and others. Allison Herschel is director and managing attorney of the Michigan Elder Justice Initiative and the elder law attorney at the Michigan Poverty Law Program, and she is one of the members of this newly created task force. Allison, why is this task force needed?
Well, I have to say I was extremely excited when this task force was announced. I've never heard public officials name the issues that this task force is talking about, and I certainly haven't heard public officials before really express a strong commitment to solving some of those problems. One of the main issues that the task force is addressing initially is some of the problems that we see in our guardianship system. And that's the system where someone is alleged to be incapacitated, and if the court agrees that they are incapacitated, a guardian can be appointed for them. But in our guardianship system across the state last year, more than 10,000 petitions for guardianship were granted. But according to the Supreme Court statistics, fewer than 150 were denied. We know that many of those hearings last only a few minutes. We know that often the person who's alleged to be incapacitated isn't present. We know that there's often not very strong evidence about the person's ability to function and need for a guardian and whether less restrictive alternatives are available. And we know that people who are alleged to be incapacitated are often not represented by a lawyer in those hearings.
So does it feel, in a sense, that it's kind of rubber stamped through?
Well, I think the figures do speak for themselves. Given that more than 10,000 petitions were granted and fewer than 150 were denied, it is hard to have a judge make a well-considered decision when a person is often not present, is often not represented by a lawyer, and the hearings are so short. And then, of course, when a guardian is appointed, usually it's a plenary guardian, which means that the guardian has the obligation to make almost all decisions in the person's life, including where they live and what medical treatment they get and what happens to their home and their possessions.
And I'm wondering, before we go further, who can apply to be guardians and what kind of background and criminal checks are there?
In our state, there is no licensure or certification requirement for professional guardians. Often a guardian is appointed who's a family member, but very often a guardian is appointed who's just an agency or an individual who is willing to serve as guardian. There is no requirement that they have any particular training or experience. And so that is a real concern, and one of the task force's very first initiatives is to require professional guardians to become certified and to require minimum training and professional standards and also bonds for these individuals. A number of other states do this, and now it looks like Michigan might well be one of the states that does, and that would be a huge advantage for us because we would finally know that the people who are responsible for our mothers and our fathers are people who have certain training and requirements and people that we can identify and whose work we can track.
It strikes me that we're not just talking mothers and fathers, but it could be, as you say, incapacitated adults, so it could be our brothers, it could be cousins, aunts, uncles. So we're talking about beyond the elderly then, if we're talking about reforms in guardianships. And I'm wondering, is there evidence that the system that we have in place now in Michigan are leading to the elderly or people who are incapacitated being taken advantage of? What does this look like?
Well, we do see that in my office every week. In part, there's an issue that because some professional guardians have more than 300 or even 400 people that they're responsible for, it's very difficult to give the kind of individual attention and concern for each individual when you're responsible for hundreds of people's lives. Sometimes that leads to neglect. Sometimes that leads to abuse. And then certainly in cases even where professional guardians don't have hundreds of wards, or even when it's a family member, sometimes we do see cases, not infrequently, where that guardian is not providing for people's most basic needs, is not making good choices about the care they receive, and is not being responsible about their finances.
What reforms do you most want to see come out of this task force when it comes to guardianships?
I think the ones that the task force listed as their initial initiatives are particularly important. I have been very concerned about the fact that our guardians aren't certified or licensed for years, and I'm delighted that that's one of the very first things that this task force will address. Some other issues that they're addressing regarding guardianship that I think are really important is a more careful look at when a guardian removes a person from their home, because we see that often guardianship is a pipeline to the nursing home. What happens is a guardian's appointed, they take the person out of their home, they move them into a nursing home because that often is an easier place to oversee that person's life, and then very quickly their homes are sold, all their possessions are sold or disposed of. So under the Elder Abuse Task Force initiative, the guardian would have to present the court with a written plan exploring all alternatives to removal. So they would have to look at, you know, can we get home and community-based services that would serve this person? Is there another way we can keep this person in their home? They'd also have to look if the person's home is sold. The court would have to review carefully the documents related to that sale to make sure that the sale was done in the person's best interest and that the appropriate sale price was obtained so that the person does benefit from the sale of that house. Another thing is that, as I said, some professional guardians have hundreds of people for whom they're responsible. The task force is suggesting that it will limit the number of wards per guardian, and I think that's hugely important because there's no way a guardian can really pay personal attention to the very important aspects of a person's life if they're responsible for so many people. And then I think there's some other important proposals. For example, one of the initiatives is that guardianship hearings should have the person present, which is already required in law but often doesn't happen. And there has to be medical testimony. There really has to be real evidence that the person is incapacitated and needs a guardian. So that's an important proposed initiative as well.
Allison Herschel is one of the members of the newly formed Michigan Elder Abuse Task Force. Thanks so much for speaking with us. I know we'll be following the work as it progresses.
Thank you very much.
And we turn now to Georgia Kalis, who's vice president of the board of directors for the Michigan Guardianship Association. Your association represents how many professional guardians in Michigan?
Right now we have 149 professional guardians, which is down from 300 10 years ago.
Oh, that's so you have, you're down a lot. Why is that?
Well, most people don't realize that professional guardians work for free for about half of their caseloads.
Give us a sense of what people do when they are a professional guardian.
So we have two types of clients, the vulnerable senior that lives out in the community. We get clients in from Adult Protective Services, pretend that Mr. and Mrs. Jones lived in a community. Months go by and the neighbors start realizing they haven't seen Mr. Jones for a long time. They might call Adult Protective Services and a representative will go in and find out that Mr. Jones passed away and that Mrs. Jones, who has Alzheimer's disease, has been taking care of herself and the electricity is off and the food is rotten. And Adult Protective Services goes to the probate court and asks for a public guardian to be assigned because they couldn't find any family members or anybody else that would be willing to step up to do that.
And then, so vulnerable seniors, and what's the other group?
The mentally ill client who is on Social Security disability, and they come through the community mental health system. Typically, this client is much younger, bipolar, schizophrenic, not taking their medication, not wanting to live in a group home. When we get those clients, there is no funding whatsoever in the state of Michigan right now for a guardian to get paid to take care of the CMH client. For the vulnerable adult side, we get paid through Medicaid $83 per month to take care of someone's complete life.
When you heard that the Attorney General's office was putting together this task force, and they tell us that they've connected with your staff, they are still recruiting members for the task force, and it fully expects your group to be at the table. What are your hopes for this task force?
We're hoping, first and foremost, to provide education to legislators and to the Attorney General's office. MGA has had our third Capitol Day this March, and we've met with every single senator and House of Representatives to try to explain what the public guardian situation is in Michigan. And rather than the task force looking at guardians as being the enemy, we're hoping that we're going to be able to educate them to realize that we are the last safety net that this state has. I'm a member of the National Guardianship Association, and I'm a registered guardian through National. We don't have any sort of registration process in Michigan, and we'd love to, but it's really hard to ask a tiny population of people to get a license or to register when you're expecting them to work for free.
Some public guardians have, you know, hundreds of wards, 300 to 400 wards, we've heard. What is your reaction to people who worry that a guardian cannot possibly take the best care of so many people?
I think the number has to be in ratio to the staff. And I think that there are companies around the state that are getting larger and larger. And the reason for that is the smaller companies are going out of business. At Michigan Guardianship Association, we put on two conferences a year, and we're constantly recruiting for new guardians to come in. But again, with the expense of a public guardian, you have to have a very large liability insurance policy. We're expected to do everything for the clients, place them, make their medical decisions, run their Social Security, change their mail. We do absolutely everything that a family would do, and yet we're complete strangers to them when we first get them. And so I think that the numbers, so long as a company that's large has enough staff to do it, I don't think there should ever be a cap on the number that an individual can have.
When you say that public guardians get nothing for taking care of people who are mentally incapacitated, so that is all that work for zero, or does money come in through some other source?
It's worse than zero, to be honest with you. When I get the phone call from the court that I was appointed to be somebody's guardian, I don't know if it's going to be Mrs. Jones, the $83 client, or if it's going to be Kevin, the $0 client. But either way, I have to go down to court, pay $20 to park, go into the courthouse, and then I have to pay $12 to buy my letters of guardianship. So I'm $32 out before I even get in. And then from that point, I'm court required to see these clients, even if we don't get paid. I'm court required to take care of them and to make sure that all of their needs are met. And we don't pick and choose the clients that we get. And so what's happened is the professional guardians that are companies get upside down where they have more free clients than they have paying clients. It's a business model that can't be sustained. Guardianship companies are closing right now in the state of Michigan at a rate of 10 per year.
Where will this end?
The worst ending would be the Michigan Guardianship Association members decide that this is something that we just can't do anymore, and then the state of Michigan would have to come in and create a public guardianship system, which would be like an adult protective services. So all 83 counties in the state, the probate courts would have an office of a guardian, and then they would become a ward of the court, where right now they're a ward to whoever their guardian is. Then the state of Michigan would assume 100% of the responsibility for a state staff person to be making someone's medical decisions. It sets up for a giant liability should a state employee do the do not resuscitate order and the client passes away, and then years down the road, family come back and say, you didn't resuscitate my grandmother. I'm going to sue the state of Michigan. Where now I have a professional liability for my medical decision making for me and my staff. So we are saving the state of Michigan hundreds of millions of dollars, but we can't get anybody to hear that they need to help save what they already have for free. And instead, we feel like now a task force is going to come to micromanage and, you know, cast a negative eye towards what we're doing. And they don't realize the manipulation, the exploitation, the neglect, that's how I get my client. And unfortunately, it's usually a family member or a neighbor that is the bad guardian. And Comerica Bank will call Adult Protective Services saying Mrs. Smith is being brought into the bank every day with the little girl that lives next door to her, and they're withdrawing $5,000 a day. And then Adult Protective Services goes into the court. Next thing you know, I'm the guardian, the public guardian, and then we have to go back behind it and realize, you know, $50,000 has been stolen. We account to the court for everything that's done. We try to go to prosecute, you know, the person who was exploiting. But I'm looking forward to educating the task force that the public guardian is the safety net. We're not the bad guy.
Georgia Kalis, Vice President of the Board of Directors for the Michigan Guardianship Association. Thank you so much for talking with us on Stateside, Georgia.
Thank you so much, Cindy. It was my pleasure.
March Madness tipped off a week ago. The NCAA college basketball tournament, of course, started with 68 teams. It ends April 8th with one national champion. Michigan and Michigan State have made it to the Sweet 16. But as IPR's Dan Wanshura reports, for some in northern Michigan, March Madness means more than basketball.
For 10-year-old Ricky Bristol, it means practicing his violin a lot.
I've actually practiced every day this week, almost every day last week, every day the week before, almost every day the week before.
Ricky has been practicing every day because he's competing in a practice competition. It's called March Madness, and it's set up just like the college basketball tournament. Whoever practices the longest and the most consistently makes it to the next round. Around 50 students started, and right now Ricky is in the Elite Eight. That's enough to motivate him to practice between 60 and 90 minutes most days. He's worried if he misses a day, his friend Elijah might catch him.
I'm so scared that he's going to pass me in the competition because his mom's probably like, Ricky's practicing like this. You better step it up.
So. The neat thing is it's kind of reinforces itself.
That's Ricky's dad, Rick Bristol. They live in East Jordan.
Because what happens is, first, the thrill of the competition makes him practice more. And then because he practices more, he sees more success on the instrument.
Do you like Ojidroi?
Yeah.
All right.
David Reimer is Ricky's violin teacher and the music director of the Dorothy Gerber Strings Program. He came up with the idea for the March Madness practice tournament.
People understand that to succeed at sports, we expect high level of effort, right? You know, we see people sweating. We see people bleeding on the playing field. We see, people persevering through a lot of things.
Reimer says he's trying to create that same kind of culture and intensity with his young music students.
You know, there's a lot of kids who have the potential to do great things, but can you keep them motivated?
Parents confirm the practice minutes of their students, and they send the results to Reimer, who adds up the scores.
I would much rather have a student practice 6 days a week for 20 minutes a day than to practice for 70 minutes on Saturday.
Depending on how far a student advances, they could win prizes like an air tour in a small plane, tickets to Avalanche Bay Water Park, or maybe just a Kilwins chocolate gift certificate. Not everyone is gung-ho about March Madness, like Blaise Seitz-Marie, a fourth grader from Charlevoix.
I'm not very motivated by the competition part.
But she says she likes keeping track of her practicing and trying to get better each time. Right now she's practicing the fourth movement of The American Quartet by Dvorak.
Yeah, I've been working on it for a long time.
How long?
For about maybe 4 months.
Blaze didn't quite make it to the Elite Eight round, but Ricky did. He'll find out if he made it into the Final Four on April 1st. For Points North, I'm Dan Wanshura.
Points North is a weekly show from Interlochen Public Radio where you learn about life in northern Michigan. Catch the full show at pointsnorthradio.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Peg Watson. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.